Dear friends and colleagues, when you honored me last year with the FEL Prize, I shared with you my personal family history, as Alberto said, and I promised to share the prize with a Polish family who saved the lives of my family, of my parents. Oops. Oh, it's very sensitive. And they saved the life of my parents at the Holocaust period, risking their own life. And this was done, and I wish, with your permission, to dedicate this lecture to the memory of Joseph and Sofia Petrovsky for their rare and courageous deed. This talk will be predominantly tutorial. I'll try to present in a physical way many things that you already know, but I chose to start with a fundamental starting point in order to arrive at the end of the talk, I hope, to problems of more recent interest, like how to make SASI FELs coherent, which I believe would be one of the subjects that will be of interest in this conference. My starting point is the old Maxwell equation, employed specifically to current sources that are microscopic, starting with particulate charges. So the charges can be either electric dipoles or magnetic dipole in the most general case, like it is in any laser, or what interests us in this conference is free electron charges. Once you start with this wide starting point, of course you have a set of four-dimensional partial differential equation. It's very difficult. You can simplify it right away at steady state by Fourier transform, moving to the frequency domain, and then a great simplification can be achieved in many structures when you can present the radiation field in terms of an expansion, in terms of a complete set of eigenmodes. Now, there are many structures like this, certainly waveguides, but also in free space, especially in laser physics, we are using the Hermite-Gaussian set of orthogonal equations, or we can also talk about plane waves, in which case the summation of the transverse modes reduces into integration over the transwave wave numbers. So in principle, when you do it, the three-dimensional partial differential equations simplify into a set of ordinary one-dimensional differential equations for the amplitude, for the complex amplitude sig u, and you can solve it directly if you know the input amplitude. So if you know sig u in, you can calculate sig u out for any distribution of charges in your volume, and then what you do with it, you substitute it back into the expansion, you get the entire field, or what is common in optics is to calculate optical parameters out of the amplitudes. So this is how it is done. What it turns out that the explicit solution of the Maxwell equation is actually accurate, is that the increment of each mode can be expressed as a sum over the contributions of all the electrons. And this is a very satisfying physical picture because each increment like this represents a wave packet that is emitted by the electron. And you can calculate this contribution. It's simply a contour integral of this function along the trajectory of the electron inside the cavity. And the trajectory of the electron is usually known. If you start, if you assume that it is not modified by the radiation field, it is definitely known, and you can perform this integral. In fact, if all the electrons have the same trajectories, and let us assume this case, then the integral will give always the same result, except for a phase factor, depending on the initial start oscillation time of each electron or the entrance time into the interaction region. So this term corresponds to the spontaneous or superradiant emission of individual electrons yet before they make any interaction with the radiation field. If they do make interaction with the radiation field, for especially if CQ in is not equal to zero, you come in with some radiation field, then you have an additional contribution, which is a stimulated emission due to the modification of the trajectories inside the interaction region. Now, what you do with it is either you put it back into the expansion, but in optics it's more common to look into optical parameters like the power or the spectral energy for a finite pulse of electrons. In either case, it is the absolute value square of the amplitude. So the absolute value square will yield a number of terms. Each corresponds to a different scheme of emission. And this is a time, indeed, to clarify definitions. And when you don't have any input fields, the emission of individual electrons depends only on the phase factors. If the electrons enter at random, then after you absolute value square, if you average over the electrons, then the only terms that will contribute to this summation square are the non-diagonal terms. There are n terms like this, so in spontaneous emission or short noise emission, you'll get emission proportional to the number of electrons. Now, if the electrons enter in phase, they are correlated. Either they all come in one bunch, or they are bunched periodically with the period, with the frequency of the emission, then all the wave packets interfere coherently, and then you get emission proportional to n square. I call it superradiance following the famous paper of Dickey, who analyzed this for the case of atoms or molecules. He did a quantum mechanical analysis because he treated both spontaneous and stimulated emission, but this effect is entirely classical. It is the same emission like the emission from a regular antenna. And it turns out that the emission is proportional to n squared. And then, of course, if the input field is non-zero, we would be interested to calculate the stimulated emission. This involves already calculation of the dependence of the wave packet amplitudes on the input field. And you can do it, for example, to first order, which is a linear gain case. So this formulation can be employed for any kind of radiation scheme, undulatory radiation, Smith-Purcell radiation, Cherenkov, and so on. But of course, our interest here is now in undulatory radiation. And for this particular case, this contour integral can be performed, at least in the spontaneous emission case, straightforwardly. And when you substitute the contour of the electrons inside the wiggler, the integral results in this expression for the wave packet amplitude in frequency domain. It is proportional to the famous sinc theta is the tuning function, this is a resonant line curve that is centered around a center frequency called the synchronism frequency, and the line width, delta omega, is the inverse of the slippage time of the radiation relative to the electrons. How does it look in the time domain? All you have to do is to take this last expression and inverse Fourier transform it to arrive back to the time domain. And then what turns out that you have a summation of wave packets that, using electrical engineering terminology, these are the impulse response functions to single electrons. And this is how it looks. You first see a radiation wave coming, then the electron, and then there is another radiation wave packet emitted, because the electron emits not only in the forward direction, but also in the backward direction, in its own rest frame. So we see it in the laboratory frame as two wave packets. Now, this wave packet is usually being ignored, and we'll ignore it for the rest of the talk. We have only the fast frequency, the fast high frequency wave packet of length T slippage. And when you inverse Fourier transform, and when you Fourier transform it, you get, of course, the line shape function that I showed, of which 2 pi over the slippage distance. And now it depends if the electrons are entering in phase or not. If they are not in phase, spontaneous emission, then you have for the spectral energy the emission of one electron times n. And if it is super radiant, they are correlated, then it is the same thing but multiplied by n squared. Now let's assume that you have a bunch of electrons. Okay, about a bunch of electrons we talked about. Now I'm interested in a special case when you have not single bunch, but a train of bunches. For example, a macro pulse from an RF LINAC. Now, I care about this example not only because it is useful by itself, but it is an interesting model to understand the possible improvement of SASE coherence, which I'll arrive to at the end. So in the time domain, the emission from a train of bunches is first you get a wave packet, then the bunch arrives, wave packet, bunch arrives, and so on. And you have a bunch of duration TP composed of NP bunches, and you have wave packets of duration T slippage composed of NW, the number of wiggles, times the optical period. And when you Fourier transform this, and we'll go back now to the frequency domain, of course, the function will depend on these two time constants, the pulse duration and the wave packet duration. And indeed, when we do that, we take the Fourier transform. If we do the same thing in the frequency domain, as you remember, we have to sum up over the contribution of all the electrons. It's possible to break the summation into summation over the electrons inside the bunch and summation over the bunches. Now, the summation over the electrons inside the bunch turns out to be just a Fourier transform of the waveform of the electron bunch, which we'll assume here to be equal to 1, which means the bunches are very tight, like a delta function. And the other term, which I call the macro pulse form factor, this is an important term, is a multi-beam interference function that I'll show it here again. It is composed of an infinite number of harmonics of the bunching frequency. And each of the harmonics is very narrow. It's equal to the line width is the inverse of the entire pulse duration, tending to a delta function if the duration if it is a CW emission. And finally, the spectral power that emitted from a train of bunches, superradiant emission, is proportional to the emission spectrum of a single bunch or a single electron times this Markov pulse form factor, times n squared. And of course, what you'll have is that only the harmonics that are within the bandwidth of the single electron emission will be filtered out by this product, as we'll see from this curve. See, this is a curve of single electron or single bunch emission. This is the Markov pulse form factor, dependence of frequency, made out of many harmonics of the bunchic frequency. And when you multiply them, this is what you get. Now, usually the emission frequency is much higher than the bunchic frequency. So you have then many harmonics within the emission curve, and you won't distinguish them unless you filter it out. And it is possible to filter this out. And then if you'll do that, you'll find out that each harmonic has a coherence time of the entire pulse, the entire macro pulse. This is, of course, assuming that the RF frequency is stable. Or if the bunchic frequency can be higher than the bandwidth, then you'll get automatically only single harmonic operation and with very high coherence. So here I show a nice experiment that was done by the MIT group of Temkin. It wasn't done with the undulator radiation, it was done with Smith-Purcell radiation, but it is the same principle. Using heterodyne detection, they were able carefully to filter out, in this case, the 14th harmonic of Smith-Purcell coherent or superradiant emission from an RF LINAC that operated at 1.7 gigahertz. They measured that at 240 gigahertz, very narrow line width emission, which corresponds to one over the bandwidth corresponds to one over the duration of the entire macro pulse. So this is a very narrow line width of 10 to the minus 4, and this is a demonstration of this macro pulse form factor. We are actually more interested in stimulated emissions, so I'll move there on the way to the SASE, and I'll talk about FEL amplifier, then an oscillator. So let us assume again that we have an RF LINAC with a FEL amplifier, and there is an input field which has wide frequency bandwidths, wider than the gain bandwidth of the FEL. So what will happen is, again, in time domain, this is what you expect that will happen. Of course, the radiation will be amplified only at the time when you have bunches, so it is time-gated by the bunches. And an additional thing that happens when there is amplification, there is also filtering by the gain bandwidth of the amplifier. So you see that it is coherent within the time of the bunch. And, of course, there is some slippage effect, so the pulses are a little modified, they are not equal to the bunch's duration. And how does it look in the frequency domain? Here is the gain curve of the FEL amplifier. Here are the harmonics of the bunchic frequency of the RF LINAC, let's say. The line width is pi over the slippage time, and when you multiply the two, this is what you get. Only modes within the gain bandwidth are being amplified. The others are not amplified, or even they may be attenuated here. And this is what you get for an FEL amplifier. Now I'm interested in an FEL oscillator. And in laser optics, it's customary to treat an oscillator as an amplifier with feedback. So an oscillator will be represented by this cartoon. Assuming now we have to make another assumption, since it is an RF-Linac oscillator, I have to assume that the bunches enter commensurate with the round trip of the resonator, which means, in the simplest case, that whenever a bunch arrives, also the wave packet, the radiation wave packets, makes one round trip around the resonator. So this looks like this. Here is a bunch. The radiation wave packet is amplified. Then part of it is being transmitted. Another bunch arrives exactly at the right time. It makes another round trip. Again, some emission. And again, there is another bunch. Until you arrive to saturation. In an oscillator, you always arrive to saturation and to steady state, in which case there is exact synchronism between the bunches and the round-trip circulations. How does it look in the time domain? Assuming there is identity between the bunching frequency and the round-trips, you get at steady state this kind of structures. There are radiation pulses that are coming synchronously with the bunches. But it's interesting to see how the steady state develops in the frequency domain. So we start with the same slide, like an amplifier. There's some signal entering, some probe signal, and there is the a gain curve, but what's new in the oscillator are two things. First of all, you have to make sure, relative to the amplifier, that there is a round trip that time that has to be synchronous with the bunching frequency. And secondly, in an oscillator, there is a threshold current. Only modes with gain higher than the threshold current can be amplified and have net amplification in a round trip. All the others have net loss and will be lost in the oscillation build-up period. So if you let the oscillation build-up process to run, there will be a finite number of modes that interact, are coupled with each other. They are gated by the times of the bunches, by the timing of the bunches. And finally, you'll get a finite number of modes within the bandwidth of the gain of the gain bandwidth, and they will be locked to each other. And in principle, the FEL oscillator, RF-Linac FEL oscillator, is exactly like a mode-locked laser, except that in active mode locking, you introduce losses, periodic losses, to lock the modes. And here's the gain, due to the bunches, locks the modes to each other. An interesting case is what if you don't have RF-Linac and you don't have bunches, assume that you have a continuous or long pulse FEL, what will happen then? You don't have then the bunching to lock the modes to each other. They're all freely running. And what will happen in the oscillation build-up, all of them could exist, but because of the nonlinear interaction, you always arrive to the nonlinear interaction, there is mode competition, and in CW case, you wind up always with a single harmonic, bunching harmonic, or there's no bunching harmonic in this case, you would call it longitudinal modes. And the single longitudinal mode that is left is, of course, very narrow line width. Okay, the line width corresponds to the duration of the pulse. And if the pulse is in infinite CW operation and everything is stable, ideally you get zero bandwidth. Of course, this is not the entire truth. I don't have the time to show it now. But then the limit is a charlatan's intrinsic limit. This is an experimental demonstration of this process in a long pulse FEL that you can do in an electrostatic accelerator, one that we have in Israel. And you can see here both the mode competition process initially and finally the emergence of a single mode. And you can see also that the line width of the mode is Fourier transform limited. It is completely coherent within the duration of the pulse, which was in this case 10 microseconds long. Okay. Now, approaching to the SASE FEL, I would talk about high gain regime of FEL. And we use the Pierce model, the linear response model. The amplitude of the mode at the end of the Wigner is proportional to the input field. This is a regular FEL amplifier. But we have to take notice that there can be also velocity modulation of the beam and current modulation or density modulation. And then you can calculate what we call the transfer functions to field, to velocity, and to current modulation using the Pierce model and using the Pierce dispersion equation. And you can calculate it explicitly. Here it is given specifically in the high gain limit. You can calculate the power output of the regular FEL amplifier. You can calculate this is at the maximum gain point, the power at the output in response to current modulation, and also there is response to velocity modulation. Axial velocity modulation can originate either from energy spread, energy modulation, or actually, this is a coherent modulation. I want to bring attention to that in addition to coherent modulation, you can have also fluctuations, which is noise. So you can have either current fluctuations or velocity modulations, velocity fluctuations. And they should be distinguished, and I'll try to show it by the following cartoons. This is the velocity distribution of an electron entering the Wigner. It has some velocity spread. This is actually should be delta VZ, the axial velocity spread. It can be caused either by energy spread or by emittance or other terms. And this is a time average. In the time average, you measure this distribution. However, if you have density modulation or current modulation, you'll have, let's see if it works, yes, nicely. This is current modulation of the density in the time domain. Now, if you, let me see how to work it. I have to move to this region, I guess, and press it again. Now, go here. This will be velocity modulation. The entire distribution is modulated. What would noise be? Current modulation noise, namely shot noise, will look like this. The frequency of the amplitude changes, but the velocity distribution doesn't change. And what would be velocity modulation? This will be velocity modulation. The distribution changes as a function of time, and what is important, please notice the average moves, and the fluctuations of the average velocity is not the same like delta V. It's a different number, and it has to be derived. And when you do that, you can get expressions for the response not only to coherent modulation, but also to density shot noise or velocity shot noise. And these are these two expressions now expressed in terms of spectral power of the SASE. This is the SASE FEL already. Instead of the spectral energy, we move to spectral power. And we have here explicit expression for current fluctuation and velocity fluctuation. This is usually neglected, but I think it should be considered, and the condition to really ignore velocity fluctuations is the following condition that we derived after comparing the two expressions for shot noise, current shot noise, and velocity shot noise. How can we make SASE more coherent? This is the subject of the end of my talk. And I want to show here this nice transparency from the statistical analysis paper of Krinsky and Gluckstein, showing the degraded quality of radiation from SASE, which is expected. If you average over many pulses, you get in the frequency domain, frequency bandwidth corresponding to the wide bandwidth of the FEL amplifier. If you look at one pulse, you can see that there are features which indicate coherence, long coherence times of the entire bunch, and the entire pulse. The pulse in this case is the micro bunch of the RF LINAC. Okay? And this is considered very narrow line widths, but it is random. How can you make it coherent? This is a question, and this is another picture in the time domain. In the time domain, it is expressed in terms of what we call spikes, spikes that appear at random time. Each of them can be have the coherence time corresponding to the inverse of the bandwidth of the high gain transfer function. So this is a model for it. You can expand and approximate the transfer function of the high-gain FEL by quadratic expansion and get this complex Gaussian, a common practice that is done. And this is the transfer function of in response to current of the FEL, and the line width is delta omega high gain. And you can inverse Fourier transform it in order to get the impulse response function. The impulse response function is a chirped Gaussian, which is a response to fluctuations in the uniform electron beam. Now, in SASE, the fluctuations are random. So you have a lot of these spikes being emitted at random. This is the situation. There are many spikes appearing appearing at random. Sometimes there are more, sometimes less. And this everything is during a pulse, which is a micro bunch of the RF LINAC of 1 picosecond or less. And the question is how to phase lock all these spikes, all these impulse response functions. So many schemes were proposed, seed radiation, which is a regular amplifier, actually, or filtering and reinjection, which is about the same, or subharmonic bunching, or HGHG, which is doing it in a cascade way. What are the criteria for these schemes to work? Using a simple analytical formulation, for the seed radiation to work, you need that the input power will be larger than the noise. The SASE is a noise amplifier. You want the signal to be larger than the noise, either the velocity or the current noise. Same thing with the subharmonic micro pre-bunching. You need that the power or the intensity of the bunching at the emission frequency will be larger than the shot noise. These are the criteria. You can either do it comparing the power of the signal within the bandwidth of the signal delta omega s, or you can do it comparing to the entire power of the SASE. In either case, this is a condition that you have to satisfy. You have to produce this kind of power in your signal to get above the noise level. You can derive similar condition for pre-bunching to work out. The amplitude of the pre-bunching should be larger than this value. Only then you'll get coherent emission. This is all of this in the frequency domain. I'll conclude with the time domain picture. This is the situation that we have in the SASE. Random impulse response functions, responding to fluctuations, to impulses that appear in random. What we want to have is this, to phase lock the different spikes, and that will get coherent emission. What is important is to have a contents of high harmonics, which requires very short impulses, very difficult to do. It doesn't have to be this. It can be also any other waveform that has high harmonic contents. How to do it? This is a question that I leave open. There are many clever people here who will present, I'm sure, in this conference, analysis more than just the analytical expression that I presented here. Well, of course, one way is to have tight bunching with a ponderomotive potential with a laser low frequency relative to the X-ray, because, like I said, it can have very high subharmonic modulation. It will work out. How effective it is? It is a question. You can get very tight bunching. Here we calculated the harmonic contents of an electron bunched with a quarter synchrotron length with a ponderomotive potential. You have high harmonic contents, but of course you'll have also velocity modulation, and I'm not sure how well it will work. So in conclusion, the general formulation that I presented can be applied to FELs in different radiation schemes, superradiance, amplifier, oscillator, but it is most interesting to look at it at the case of the SASE, which is would be probably of high interest in this conference. And I cannot say what will be the ultimate thing that is possible to achieve. I would speculate that it is likely that only partial coherence can be attainable. Namely, it will be hard to produce optical short impulses. However, it may be possible to increase the probability that the spikes will appear in time and lock in phase, and then by statistical averaging over bunches, it may be useful also for spectroscopic applications, which is one of the applications foreseen for this important XUV source. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for this quite interesting presentation, quite clear, in spite of the fact that it's theoretical, that you are able always to say, to be so clear, and especially for this last part, quite important for us, is probably for the coherence in the SAS devices. So the section is open for the questions, comments. So, I have a question just on this last point, quite challenging point of the coherence. Do you believe that the degree of coherence of this kind of device could be improved also by handling just an electron beam and having some kind of feedback from different. I heard some other proposal that feedback is through other beams or such a kind of.
Of course, the example of the FEL oscillator would have been a nice example because then you have a mechanism that rearranges the longitudinal modes and locks them in phase. But I don't know how you can do it in a structure like this. And maybe I didn't study it. Maybe when you approach saturation, you would have some better possibility to lock the spikes. I'm not sure about that.
Questions?
Last year, I was invited to present a talk in the laser science conference, that is for the atomic laser or conventional laser. And somebody said, is there stimulated emission phenomena in the FEL? But I couldn't respond to this question. Could you give some comment on this question?
Yes, I can refer you to an old paper was published in the Review of Modern Physics maybe 15 years ago showing the transition from the quantum limit to the classical limit. People often think that stimulated emission has to be a quantum effect. Stimulated emission is an emission in response to a radiation field that comes. But to satisfy these people, you can start from a quantum approach and really show that that the condition of having synchronism is equivalent to the condition of resonance between two levels that in the quantum limit exist also in an FEL, and that what is called in regular lasers population inversion condition is simply satisfied by having the electron beam slightly faster than the synchronism condition. It can be all shown to be equivalent to the conventional laser physics for terminology for stimulated emission. So there is stimulated emission also in the classical limit.
Thank you very much.
Other question? I saw some. Okay. Charlie Brown.
Thank you. At the other end of the spectrum from the X-rays are the terahertz devices, and it seems increasingly difficult to explain the Dartmouth terahertz Smith-Purcell results in terms of a backward wave oscillator. They seem to be too far below threshold as we get better and better estimates of what the backward wave oscillator threshold should be. Is it possible that the increase in the superradiant emission that they see at about a milliamp is really a statistical phenomenon that comes about without actually achieving oscillation threshold, something like that.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie. I was actually, it's a different subject. I was deeply interested in it too because I started with Smith-Purcell analysis and experiments, and I actually checked this particular point. In my opinion, the Dartmouth experiment did not demonstrate stimulated emission at all. I studied and talked with the people, and I think that the nonlinear growth of emission as a function of current, which is usually an indication for stimulated emission, was caused because while changing the current, they also change the focusing of the electron beam. So it seemed like there is an increase of power emission, but it is not. It is due to having the electron beam more focused. So my opinion is that in that experiment, stimulated emission was not demonstrated. It was spontaneous emission at right angle to the grating. And it doesn't mean to say that the process of backward wave interaction that you suggested, that in consequence you have superradiant emission from the tight bunching, is not a valid process. It can happen. But I believe this is not the process that explains the experiment. The explanation of that experiment is much simpler. It wasn't stimulated emission, in my opinion.
Okay. Just last question.
My question is just very simple. Could you make clear the definition of the superradiance? Is there any difference from the simple, coherent, synchrotron radiation from a single bunch?
If I'll be able to, I wonder if I can succeed to get this. No, I have a transparency on that, explaining it in terms of Dickey's analysis. Oh, yes, it is. Here it is. Yeah. This demonstrates the analysis of Dickey, who looked into the superradiance problem, which is emission from an ensemble of atoms emitting in phase in the case that the emission is at a wavelength larger than the dimensions of the emitters, which is the case, for example, in nuclear magnetic resonance or electron spin resonance, where they emit in the microwave regime, and they prepare the dipoles, magnetic dipoles or electric dipoles, by means of what is called a pi over 2 pulse. So he looked into the emission of such an ensemble of radiators, microscopic radiators, and like in an atom, they can emit coherently with each other in this particular case. And in the quantum mechanical language, the emission rate is proportional to this expression, where R is the angular momentum quantum number, which can go with multiples of half up to the number of electrons divided by 2. And at the most, you'll have this much angular momentum. And then what matters is, in this case, what is M is the quantum number corresponding to the projection of the angular momentum vector on the magnetic field in the case of electron spin resonance, or the electric field in case of superradiance from regular laser media. And what happens is that with this formula, you can see the two limits. When you have one electron, then the emission is equal to I0. This is a spontaneous emission, which is in this case a real quantum effect. However, when R equal N over 2, all the electrons are oscillating, are all prepared to be at the maximum emission rate, which is quantum number M equal to 0, which means a giant dipole rotating like this. In this case, the emission is proportional to the number of electrons squared. It is exactly the same thing with a bunch of electrons. And it is exactly the same emission like the emission from the antenna of regular classical telephone cell. So this emits power proportional to the current square. So this is an entirely classical emission, and even free electrons, if they are being bunched to a duration shorter than the emission period, or big periodically bunch will emit radiation in proportional to the N square or to the Karn square. So this is how I view the superradiant emission. Or it's completely legitimate to call it coherent emission. Many people are using this term. The same thing like CSR, it's the same process.
Thank you. Arvid, for